Welcome to Reboot Republic and the Echo Chamber podcast. I'm Rory Hearn, and we're here today with Martin McMahon, who's joining us for a together podcast, Tortoise Shack Cross podcast, because we're joined, absolutely delighted to be joined by Professor Anthony Staines from DCU and also the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group. Martin, how are you?
Great, thanks, Rory. Great. How are you keeping?
I'm good. You're fresh off your appearance at the PAC, and you've rocked the world in highlighting bogus self-employment. All of us precarious workers been left with no rights. How did you feel it went?
I thought it went really well. I enjoyed doing it. You know, I'm a long time waiting to take a crack at it. Little bit perturbed about the statements put in by Revenue and Social Welfare, particularly where the Department of Social Welfare has said they don't use test cases, where they've already told the PAC in writing that they use test cases. So why even bother coming out with a statement saying you don't? So I'm expecting that whenever their session goes ahead in the PAC, I'll receive a full and frank apology from the department for calling me a liar yet again.
Look forward to hearing that, Martin. I really do. I really do. And a reminder to our listeners that we were an independent media, rely on you for our support. You can become a patron. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And for $5.50 a month, you can get access to live shows like we have. And a reminder, Reboot Republic 100 live next Friday the 9th. And consolidated podcasts across the Tortoise Shack platform. So you can never miss a podcast. So please, if you can, support us. Now, today we're going to talk about COVID-19, the government strategy, where are we at, the vaccine program. We've seen frontline workers like teachers and guards who had been prioritized now suddenly not being prioritized, going on the age list. We've seen the talk of cases. We've seen questions around schools. And we're delighted to be joined, as I said, by Professor Anthony Staines, from DCU and a member of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group. Anthony, what was your reaction to the government's latest plan? What do you think of it?
I think it's a plan for substantial economic restrictions till vaccination is completed, which really means early autumn at best. And it's an unambitious plan. It's a plan that doesn't have a very clear goal. You know, we drift along until we vaccinate everybody and then we see what happens. And, you know, hopefully when we do vaccinate most people, things will be substantially better than they are now. But it's a very vague plan. They're bringing in other bits and pieces. So they're bringing in mandatory hotel quarantine. And there's now a proposal to extend that effectively to most of the European Union. They're bringing in what they call backward tracing. So trying to find out where people got infected from, but they're not going back far enough. They're going to loosen restrictions as things stand with a very unstable situation. The numbers are going up and down a lot every day. They've been down the last 2 days, so hopefully that will continue. And that would obviously be immensely positive for everybody. But there's no guarantee that will continue. And it really is wing and a prayer stuff. And it's sitting on a wing and a prayer for a long time.
From what we can gather from NPHET would prefer that we hold fast for 6 weeks till the vaccination program is running at full tilt. But the government seem to have digressed from what NPHET want on that. Are we going to pay a price?
Well, NPHET's plan is essentially to keep going as we are at a high level of restrictions till something good happens. And the government's plan is to keep going as we are at a somewhat lower level of restrictions till something good happens. And neither, in all honesty, is much of a plan. This is not how you deal with major outbreaks of disease anywhere. And there's no special reason to suppose it will work here. We haven't done as badly as some of our European peers in managing COVID, but we have done much less well than we could have, you know, given that we're a small island without a huge amount of cross-border movement. We really should have done better than we have. And it's been about avoiding making decisions. It's been about making the easy choice at every fork in the road. We had a choice between, you know, let's bring in a plan and bring this under control. And, well, things look a bit better, so let's open up. We've chosen to open up each time. We haven't brought in, we're a year into a pandemic and we're just beginning to bring in serious public health interventions. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, absolutely ridiculous. The cost of the restrictions, even the direct cost to the exchequer, is mind-boggling. Never mind the costs to jobs, the cost to corporations, the cost to individuals, the lost income. It's many tens of billions. And for want of spending a maximum of 40 or 50 million in public health, we have spent tens of billions on rolling lockdowns, which keep bringing us back to the place we started out. And Senator McDougall had a piece in the paper yesterday essentially saying the population were at breaking point. Now, actually, it's not true. The poll evidence is relatively clear that while people are not happy, that they're willing to continue going along as we are at the moment. But he has a wider point that we have asked a lot of the Irish people, and we haven't done the other bits. We haven't done the public health pieces. We haven't done the quarantine at the ports pieces. We have, to an extent, done the testing piece. That's gone reasonably well. And the vaccination piece is going reasonably well. And the hope is that in, where are we now? April, May, June, July, August. In 6 months' time, by September, most people will be vaccinated. The number of circulating cases will have fallen right down and we will be in a much better position. That might not happen. It might not happen for two reasons. One is that we have no immediate plan to vaccinate children and we probably need to do that. Now, there is work published in the last few days suggesting that these vaccines can be used effectively and safely in children and adolescents. I think there's more work to come on that, and that should be clearer in a month or two. But vaccinating that group is just going to take time. And the second concern is that there are at least two strains circulating against which the vaccines we are using give limited protection. Now, limited protection, especially limited protection from being dead, is far better than no protection. It's probable that, as is the case for flu, if you get vaccinated, even if the vaccine isn't a great protection against getting sick, it is a great protection against getting really sick, and it's a great protection against dying. So, you know, whatever the future holds, there's no downside to getting vaccinated now. But there is a risk that we will have a variant circulating, which is not covered properly by the vaccine by the autumn. And we've seen this in Europe, where a variant which arose in the UK, and it arose in the UK because the UK allowed uncontrolled spread of COVID-19. The UK pursued a herd immunity strategy at the beginning of the pandemic. They didn't say that's what they were doing, but that's what they were doing. And 100,000 dead people later, we have a UK strain of the virus, which is now tearing through Europe. It's the same strain we have here, but it's tearing through Europe. It's causing many, many hundreds of deaths. It's causing tens of thousands of cases. It's causing economic disruption beyond measure. And that strain is likely to spread around the world. In the same way, there is a strain which was first identified in Brazil, another strain first identified in South Africa, both countries where the pandemic got out of control, and it's still out of control in Brazil. And these strains are here. They're in Ireland already. And we're just hoping that we can control them, that they won't spread.
And is that maybe, you know, to come back, there's two things that I think strike me out of what you're saying. The first is that question of the variants and limited effectiveness, and potential more variants developing, of course, in the coming months, that the approach to mandatory hotel quarantine, and we're seeing now, as you said, potentially European countries going on that, that the government really has not put in place an effective hotel quarantine system in place that will actually protect us. It has it. And what would an effective mandatory hotel quarantine, not just the specific hotels, but what would an effective quarantine response in terms of incoming passengers look like? Should it be all passengers?
Yeah, it should be all passengers, with exceptions for people like aircrew drivers. And there's a very, very tiny number of highly specialized people who essentially repair things that no one in Ireland repairs. But I can think of three or four of them in the healthcare system. And I'm sure there are others in other parts of industry. So for those very small groups of people, you need different arrangements. We have to accept the Northern Ireland border is not going to be the same as the border with the rest of the UK. And we just have to get over that. People who want to will come from the UK, from the mainland UK to Belfast, and then they will come across the border. And that's just life. You know, you play the cards you're given. You manage the things you can manage. You live with the things you can't manage. And for all sorts of reasons, we can't and we won't, that I can see, ever bring in quarantine across the Northern Ireland border. I just don't ever see that happening in any real world. But I can well see it happening between ourselves and the UK and the mainland UK.
And do you see this government expanding it because it's been so reluctant to do it properly?
It's very hard to know. There's clearly a serious discussion about it within government. There's been some very obvious leaks to the newspapers about it, about the dissent, about the arguments about it. Is it the right thing to do? Yeah, it is the right thing to do because it's part of a control strategy. Will they do it? Honestly, I don't know. The recommendations now cover almost every country in Europe except the UK. And will we go down that road? I don't know. I rather hope we will. The logical thing for us to do on the British Isles would be to manage the two islands as a unit. But that was never on the cards. The English government never wanted to manage this virus effectively and have failed abysmally to manage it. I mean, the magnitude of their failure is just horrifying.
In that sense, Anthony, we've decided on vaccine rollout to now follow the UK model and go with the oldest, most vulnerable people first. Now, there seems to be some very good logic behind that, but is it the right way to go?
It's the nature of this that you don't know, and you're not going to know. It's not unreasonable. First, that I suppose the first thing to say, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm getting vaccinated tomorrow because I'm medically vulnerable. So
good for you. Good for you.
Absolutely. But is that the right? There's an argument that says you vaccinate the people who are transmitting, which is young people at the moment. And over the last few months, what's been happening is the infection rises in younger people and then spreads into older people. That's been the dynamics. So you could make a case for saying we vaccinate the younger people. Given the supply we have, that may not be the most efficient. It may be the most efficient way of interrupting transmission, but it may not be the most efficient way of interrupting deaths and reducing hospital admissions and intensive care admissions. So the government has made a series of choices, which are, you could make other choices, but you have to make choices because we don't have enough vaccines. And but their choices are not unreasonable.
But Tomás Ryan said, you know, yesterday, the cause of COVID-19 is exposure to SARS-CoV-2. Risk of exposure is greater for essential workers, especially under restrictions and especially in socially interactive work environments, for example, schools. And also essential workers contribute to population transmission. So they should be vaccinated. Is there not really an argument, particularly when we want to keep things like schools open? We want our guards to be safe. I just don't get it. That why this change, when clearly there was an agreement there, doesn't it make logical sense to continue on that basis? We're trying to buy society into this.
Well, I think Pascal Donoghue put his finger on it. He said, we haven't got a list of teachers. So
the teaching council has a list of teachers. Every teacher has to register with the teaching council.
They do. But the government don't. And what happened was they ran into huge problems with cohort 4. They discovered with cohort 4, they didn't have any lists. They didn't have lists of vulnerable people. They didn't have lists of people with diabetes. We don't have a list of the population, never mind subgroups within the population. So, again, in the interest of full disclosure, my wife is a teacher. So I see this in the sharp and pointy end as well. I think that we should be vaccinating people who are in close contact with others. And I would start, as we did with healthcare workers, then you need to vaccinate the people in the preschool and the special schools, the teachers and the SNAs, because there's a very high rate of infection in preschools. And the people in the special schools, once the disease gets in, the students can be quite vulnerable for a whole bunch of different reasons. And the logic then is you do the primary schools and the secondary schools. The problem that arises is you've also got to think about, well, what about the guards? What about the fire service? What about people who work in retail? Who are probably the main people who have extensive regular contact with the public. And can we do those? And I don't know the answer to that question. I think you could certainly try. I see why it's impossible.
I know in the UK when they first went with the idea of herd immunity in the UK, what they actually said at the time was that they were going to use kids as the tap to turn it on and off. Mm-hmm. They'd open schools, let it spread, put them out into the population. As soon as it reached a point that they figured the hospitals get overrun, they'd turn it off again. Is that essentially what we've done by default?
No, to be fair to our government, they've been very upfront that they're not pursuing a herd immunity strategy. They're pursuing a vaccination strategy. And we can see that. Look at if you take the most brutal figure, look at the number of dead people. Too many people have died in Ireland. I wouldn't argue that for a moment. But compared to what would have happened if we'd gone for herd immunity strategy, it's a fraction. Now, the British are beginning to see the price of their strategy. There's a paper published today in the BMJ, which is a follow-up of people who were hospitalized with COVID. And they have a very scary death rate and a very scary rate of being readmitted to hospital. So it's become clear that this is a very nasty disease with serious long-term effects in a minority of people, but a substantial minority of people.
And those readmitted, there is a high death rate with those readmitted as well. That would show that you are better off not getting this virus at all that full full suppression, whatever you can do to limit the numbers of people who are getting infected, not just ending up in hospitals, but getting infected should be your focus. What can we do to achieve that? I mean, we have high numbers. We've had high numbers for 6 months. If it all goes south again, as Neffet are worried about, we'll have huge high numbers again. How do we prevent that?
Even if it doesn't go south, Martin, we're going to potentially have 160,000 cases between now and the end of the summer anyway.
Yeah.
I would second Martin's question. What if you were in power, if you had control, Anthony, what would you do? What should they do?
Well, we know what to do. Okay. We know it's not easy. One of the messages that's really hard to get across in this is there's no silver bullet. Vaccinations don't fix it. If lockdowns eradicated COVID, it'd be long gone in this country. They don't. With the best will in the world, they don't. But our best guess, this is a new virus, but our best guess based on a lot of experience with other viruses, with other pandemics, our best guess is that if you did a very intensive public health approach, something like the approaches they've used in New Zealand, Australia, Korea, Taiwan, where you really put resources into public health, you put bodies on the ground, on telephones or traveling around, finding cases, supporting people to isolate. You know, you're still in a country where there's no statutory entitlement to sick leave a year into a pandemic. The number of small outbreaks that have been seeded by people who couldn't afford to stop working is frightening. It would have been much cheaper to pay all those people their full, every penny of their salaries for the time they were isolating. It really would. It would have saved a fortune.
It comes back to penny wise, COVID foolish, I think is what it's scrimping on pennies when the bigger picture is slipping by them.
It comes back to having a plan, Martin. I mean, we see this. Rory has forgotten more about housing than I will ever know. But as a non-housing expert, you know, what I see when I look at our housing policies is a running sore of a crisis with little bits of Band-Aids thrown at it every so often because it's in the box marked too difficult to fix.
Mm.
And COVID was put into the box marked too difficult to fix. And, I suspect COVID is much easier to fix than housing.
I think you're probably right. It is.
I think we could fix COVID much more easily.
I think as well, though, I think you're absolutely right, though, that it's a certain amount, it's too difficult. But it also reflects, I think, a lack of ambition of the state. And I remember talking to Julian Marseille about this, about a number of weeks ago, I was really pushing, going, why would they not just do proper public health? Why not just do proper mandatory hotel quarantine? And he made some good points. He said, it's like they just don't want to do something big and they don't want to disturb interests as well, who they think will get a bit upset and they don't want to ruffle feathers, perhaps of the foreign direct investment of the investors. They don't want to, the mandatory order, maybe that might disturb them a little bit. And they don't want to take on something like investing in public health that sets some precedence, that we have to keep investing down the line. That's kind of constant short-termism rather than actually going, no, let's take this on and let's take the risk of failing at this, but let's really go after it properly. To me, it's like it is that lack of ambition and that unwillingness to ruffle a few feathers of interest that they think they prioritize.
I think that's pretty fair. And, the economy is paying a heavy price for it, and so is the Irish population. But to be fair to the government and to Neffet, there are other places have done much, much worse. So we have not done great, but we've done much better than we could have done. There are some really disastrous outcomes out there, including in our nearest neighbours.
And we're looking at an upcoming disaster across Europe where a fourth wave has already taken hold. We've seen schools in France closing. Is easing up on restrictions now the opposite to what Europe is doing as a whole? Is that in any way a clever move?
I think every country has to manage their own situation. I mean, one of the messages that comes out, again, from experience in this area is all of this is local. This has to be managed, not just country by country, but county by county and town by town. And it is a matter of using every tool in the box that you've got, because we have very few tools. We have hand washing, we have masking, we have social distancing, we have aggressive case finding, testing, source investigations. We know where you got infected. Supported isolation and contact tracing and isolation of contacts. That's more or less. And then we have vaccination. And something that maybe people don't really get, well-informed vaccine specialists last March, I mean, the people whose lives were built around doing vaccines, thought it might be 2 or 3 years before we had a COVID-19 vaccine. So what's actually happened is really almost miraculous. You know, we have not one, we have 5 or 6 well-established working vaccines for this appalling disease. There is an issue about availability, both in wealthy countries and globally. Mm-hmm. And you know, the opposition to allowing the free use of the technology at the World Trade Organization is, I think, utterly deplorable. And it's very, again, it's very short-sighted, because, you know, this is not a virus we can allow to circulate with equanimity. It will come back and bite us if we do at some point. But we nonetheless, in a year, we have a mass vaccination program underway in a small part of the world. And we should, within another year, have mass vaccination underway across the planet. And that's quite an achievement. Not perfect, but far from it. Not fair, also far from it. But much, much better than could have been expected.
On the issue of fairness, Anthony, we spoke to João Pino in Portugal. He's part of the Portuguese government there a while back. And they had one of their officials, be it a medic or whatever it was, who took the vaccine out of order, who you know, gave themselves the vaccine when they shouldn't have. And they thought very long, well, they didn't think long, but they thought very hard about what they were going to do. And they eventually gave a 6-month prison sentence. They did that so they could nip it in the bud, so that people very clear, there's a priority list. We stick to the priority list. We are seeing time and time again that the priority list in Ireland is, and I hate to say this, it's a joke, because people are usurping the list, and in a wholesale way, they're usurping the list. Do you think that undermines everything that the medics are trying to do?
I think they need to distinguish two situations. One is the situation where you're running a vaccine clinic and you have a number of doses of vaccine left at the end. And it's just the nature of this. It is really hard to, it sounds trivial, but it is really hard to match the number of doses to the number of bodies. And the decision in the Beacon to take the doses of vaccine 10 kilometers to a school when there was a school across the road was just stupid. But actually the decision to give it to somebody was not stupid. I would have preferred if they'd gone down to their car park and given it to the first 10 people who walked in, rather than throw it out. Because, you know, there's no upside to throwing out vaccine. If you're not going to give it to somebody who's on the list, and it has taken time to get the process of managing the lists up, but it has worked. There's an organization I work with where we have quite a number of frontline staff, and we vaccinated about 300 of them, literally with the dribs and drabs left over from vaccination for other frontline staff in the hospital sector. So we would get a call saying, there's a vaccine clinic in Portlaoise. We have 200 doses and 194 people. Can you send 6 people? And we did. Because the alternative was to throw out the doses. And we ended up with a couple of clinics run specially for our staff. But these are frontline care staff. So they needed access to the vaccine anyway. But making that work efficiently and smoothly is hard. And mistakes happen. And misjudgments happen. I think what the Beacon did was misjudgment. But I think if they'd thrown it out, I would have been much more inclined to jump up and down in their head. I think what they should have done was taken it across the road, the primary school across the road, and given it to them. That would have been entirely reasonable thing to do. But I don't think anyone should throw this stuff out. I don't think people should be persecuted for giving it to people when there is vaccine over, when they've done what they were meant to do. They've done the people on their list. The problem is, essentially, you can get Pfizer sell the vaccine as 5 doses. You can routinely get 6 doses. And often 7. So you end up, just because of variation in packaging and variation in skill and variation in experience, you can end up with more doses than you planned. And it's hard to predict. So I think we need to be careful in our rush to judgment of what people did. People made mistakes. I don't think what the Beacon did was sensible. I think it was the optics of it are dreadful. But at least they used the vaccine. If they'd taken the vaccine and squirted it down the sink, I would have seriously favored closing them. But they didn't. They gave it to people. They gave it to the wrong people, arguably. I don't dispute that. But we want to be careful, because, you know, the evidence is that the vast majority of the vaccine doses are being given to people at high risk. So we have vaccinated healthcare staff, almost all of them at this point. We vaccinated almost all the over 80s at this point, and we're working our way down. And we're now trying to vaccinate a fairly diverse and more challenging group, which is the medically high risk people. So it's people like me, essentially. And then we kind of work our way down. But we are doing, there's a narrative that's grown up that the vaccine rollout is a disaster, mostly delivered by people who have no idea how to do a vaccine rollout, no idea what's involved in it, and no experience doing it. So I have experiences running vaccine clinics, giving vaccines. I've never set up a vaccine program, but I've some idea what's involved. And actually, we're doing pretty well. But we're not doing perfectly.
And I think it's important that people hear that, do you know what I mean? And hear what is the practicality of it and the reality of it. And we have a rational discussion about it, and an honest and open one where it's transparent. And I think that is really important. And it's important to be balanced when we look at this. But I think we can't get away from the fact, and for me, it's brought up the inequalities in society, the harsh inequalities. that even within experiences within the pandemic that have come out, and you referenced it, you know, that we don't have statutory sick leave, that people are in horrendous situations of overcrowding, that have no possibility to self-isolate, that, you know, a third of households are struggling financially, that there's an absence of a consideration. And yes, there's been some great work done, for example, with homelessness, around homelessness. But there's been, for me, a real absence of that consideration of inequality and how COVID has exacerbated it. And how we need to respond and include that within our responses.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree. But one of the things this pandemic has done everywhere, it finds the weak places in your society and it hammers them. And it's done the same here. And in some ways, it is forcing us to look at the things we haven't done. And the big things we haven't done are we haven't ensured fair and equitable employment, as Martin pointed out to the PAC yesterday. We haven't ensured fair access to housing, which is your field of expertise. And we have a health service, which is resolutely a two-tier health service. And we haven't addressed any of those things. And in some ways, there's an American phrase I'm quite fond of, which is never waste a good crisis.
Mm.
And to an extent, we have wasted this crisis. If I look in my own sector in health, we came into this crisis with, you know, pathetically inadequate ICT systems. We still have pathetically inadequate ICT systems. There's no plan for fixing them. We are trying to deploy unique health identifiers so that we can answer questions like, well, has that Anthony Staines been vaccinated and should he have been vaccinated? We can't answer that because we haven't got any lists. We are still thinking about deploying it. We haven't done it. My public health colleagues started the pandemic chasing cases on spreadsheets, pencil and paper. There was a system hacked up very quickly, and that, you know, that's a good thing. It was a very quick system, knocked together in, I think, Microsoft System Dynamics, which is a grand package. In New Zealand, my New Zealand colleagues started exactly the same. They bodged together something very quick to work on and get themselves up and running. And then they spent the subsequent year refining it. So they now have a very slick, very professional system that ties together the labs, the mobile phone apps, the hospitals, the GPs, the public health people, the contact tracing people, all in one system. My public health colleagues are still working with spreadsheets, pencil and paper, and the system that was hacked together at the beginning of the crisis. It hasn't been substantially refined or improved since then. And that tells you a great deal about how we view change. We make the minimum necessary change to stop everybody kind of falling in a heap, and then we don't follow through. And I think this, again, is something that goes beyond just healthcare, but it's very obvious to me in the healthcare sector that we keep making very marginal changes and wondering why nothing substantial gets better. We are going to exit, please God, this pandemic this side of next Christmas, hopefully. We will have queues in the health service like you wouldn't believe. We still have no integrated waiting list management system. We don't know how many of the people in the waiting list are still alive. We don't know how many have been treated. We don't know whether people are getting better or getting worse. We don't have systems in place to keep people well, to keep people out of hospital. if you look, just take one very simple thing. The ASRI have a report out earlier this week on waiting lists for hip surgery. And that's fine. That's an entirely reasonable thing to measure. But we're not measuring function. So we're focusing on getting an operation. We're not focusing on how the patient is. So in other countries, they have hip programs. And if you have a pain in your hip, they x-ray you to see, is this arthritis, which is it normally is. And then they while you're waiting to see if you need surgery, they give you physiotherapy. They help you lose weight. They help you mobilize. They help you make the best of life you can with an arthritic hip. And at some point, you run out of road on that path, and then they replace the hip. But you get more years in good quality with that approach than you do with our approach, where you lie around and loiter till you see the consultant, and you lie around and loiter some more till you have an operation. So we don't think of this as a system. We keep thinking of hips as a problem of doing operations. But it's not a problem of doing operations. Nobody wants a hip replacement. People want to be able to move without pain. And they don't really care how you do it. But we don't have the systems in place to deliver that.
I think what you're saying, Anthony, both historical and in the last year, and I think we can go back to Roy Keane in Saipan, and we can say, if you fail to prepare, prepare to fail. Mm-hmm. And we haven't prepared our health system in 40 years. Mm-hmm. In the year they've had to put things together, our contract tracing hasn't been prepared. Our list, the simple thing, who gets vaccinated first, in what order? They had a full year to come up with that, mm-hmm. and they still haven't got it. So we are in a position where it's all down to failures to prepare, failures to know that there is a pandemic around the corner, which was warned about for decades, and nobody acted upon it. We've been told for a very long time that our health service is not fit for purpose. And yet, as you said, other than tweaks at the margins, they have failed to prepare our public health mm-hmm. system for so much as a bus crash, never mind a pandemic. How do we change that?
We change it a couple of different ways. The civil service is a fascinating body. Most civil servants, with a small number of exceptions, are hardworking, clever people who go into the civil service because they want to provide good service to others. There are always exceptions, but that's true of the majority. I know the Department of Health very well. There are one or two people in the Department of Health who make you roll your eyes towards heaven, but the proportion is lower than in many other organizations of comparable size. So there's lots of talented people in a system that doesn't work. And their system doesn't reward planning. It doesn't reward preparation. It doesn't reward delivery. You know, the HR system, the civil service, is fascinating. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And again, it's run by people who are capable, well-meaning, and their hearts are in the right place, but it doesn't work. There's very little level of accountability, either political accountability or accountability within the civil service. Rocking the boat is the major sin you can commit in either sector. And that culture has to change. I see HSC, which is, again, full of bright, capable people. You go around the world anywhere, you will find herds of Irish healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, physios, SLTs, and healthcare managers in senior positions holding responsible roles because they're well-trained, they're clever, and they're adaptable. But you bring them onto their home turf, the whole is way less than the sum of the parts. And again, it comes down to the culture of the organization. Now, the culture in HSE is not good. The people in HSE, with a few exceptions, are lovely. There's some great, great people in HSE. But the culture in the organization is not good and it doesn't deliver. And the for a minister dealing with that, it's easy to point at minister this and minister that and say it's all their fault. But they're coming into a system which has significant built-in limits. And, you know, my day job is looking at systems. And you probably know the first law of systems. The first law of systems is that every system does exactly, precisely, and only what it is designed to do. That is not necessarily what you want it to do, but it's what you designed it to do. And we're not asking a system question about the health services. And I think we're not asking a system question about the wider civil service. We inherited our civil service structure and much of our civil service culture from Britain. And it was one of our very positive inheritances from the empire, was a functioning civil service. Not every colony was so fortunate. But maybe it is time for a really hard look at what the civil service is for and how the culture of the civil service should be. And how the culture and the health service should be. And a lot of that comes about from focusing what you want it to do. You know, ask yourself, well, what do we want the health service to do? We want it to deliver patient-centered care at the appropriate point of complexity, but preferably the lowest point of complexity. So let's do it. What do we need to do to make that happen? How do you go about changing that culture? And, you know, the culture change is possible. British Airways is the famous business school example. British Airways had the worst culture of any European airline, possibly of any airline, in the 80s. They got in a new chief executive who said, this is ridiculous. And they changed their culture in about 18 months from a kind of the passengers are a pain. Wouldn't this place be much better with no passengers? To the passengers are the center of what we do. Maybe we need to do something similar in health. But how we do that is a different question. But I think it may be the kind of change we need to make.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, the whole question of culture and I think the absence, for me in particular, of frames and values like human rights and how we integrate that into our you know, services and, you know, the purpose, as you say, of what is the organization there for. And also, I think the values that frame government, the values that frame society, I think are so important that we discuss what are they and what are our priorities. And I think society in Ireland has rapidly changed and we want a more equal society. We want a society where everybody is included, that delivers proper public services, that ensures that nobody is left aside. And I think the problem is our civil service doesn't operate on that basis. And our state is not set up on that basis. And I think our state and institutions and government have to catch up with what people want and the values of where people are at now. Professor Anthony Staines, I really appreciate you joining us today on our joint Reboot Republic and Echo Chamber podcast. It was brilliant to have you. And I know there will be loads of people listening to this and really to in terms of how we respond to COVID. There's so much there of what you've set out that we needs to be done. And a reminder as well to our listeners that you can join. We have Reboot Live coming up next Friday evening, Friday the 9th. And we're going to have a great evening marking Reboot 100. And you can become part of that and find out our more. Check out and get our other episodes from the Echo Chamber, Reboot Republic, and the other podcasts from patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Please go over, sign up for Fiverr a month and become part of it and support us. Anthony Staines, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Anthony. Always my favorite Gaeler, always.
Yeah, I'm your only favorite.